From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Floating format tonight. Later, Jim Eldridge joins us. What if reality isn't what you think? The universe solved. Well, we knew this was bad, but we didn't know just how bad. Fish caught near wastewater treatment plants serving five major U.S. cities had residues of pharmaceuticals in them, including medicines used to treat high cholesterol, allergies, high blood pressure, bipolar disorder, and depression, according to researchers. Findings from this first nationwide study of human drugs in fish tissue have prompted the Environmental Protection Agency to significantly expand similar ongoing research to more than 150 different locations. Len Horowitz, internationally known authority in behavioral science, is on with us now. Len, we knew this was bad, but I guess we didn't know how bad, but I bet you did.
Yeah, well, I've seen it before. It's actually a hideous criminal assault on biology. It's called pharmaceutical sorcery in the Bible and antibiology in the laboratory. You know, it's also the antibiotics. It's not just those drugs that they've mentioned. And the hideous effects of all of this is omnicidal. It's literally operating under the guise of public health and modern medicine. It's the effective killing of biology, not just human, but also the entire ecology is at risk.
Len, how do these pharmaceuticals, stay in the water supply system? Why aren't they filtered out?
Well, because it's the same kind of thing when you put nanosilver in water. It stays in there. Like with the OxySilver product, they don't even need to have any antibiotics and vaccinations because they're basically made obsolete by water and what it can carry, like silver, which is a superconductor, which can then carry specific frequencies to literally break down viruses, break down bacteria, all naturally with little cost and highly effective with no side effects whatsoever. This is what we should be doing, but instead you've got a global elite controlling the what I call the military medical petrochemical pharmaceutical cartel, and they're poisoning everything, George.
You know, last night I was watching a movie, and in the movie, a woman went and got a prescription for a doctor for depression. And this, again, now this is a movie, drama. And she came home, didn't want to take her pills, and dumped them all down the drain and washed them away. And I was just looking at that, Len, and I said, man, that stuff's going into our drinking water.
That's what it's, I mean, everything is. Look at the mercury and dental fillings going down the tubes. And then the water is the living water. This is what the concert for the living water is all about. Waking people up about not only the truth that shall sustain us and keep us from being intoxicated and poisoned, but literally all of the most urgencies can be resolved with the universal solvent, water. It is so special, and they're poisoning it. Essentially, I believe that this is literally a completely satanic attack against reason, as well as humanity, as well as ecology.
And, you know, even though this was in five cities under the test, it was probably going to be found in all cities in the United States, all water treatment plants. Dr. Len Horowitz, his website, Dr. DR, drlenhorowitz.com, linked up now at Coast to Coast. AM.com. Scientists believe they are a step closer to curing tinnitus. They have found what could be the root cause of ringing in the ears. Studies show hearing loss can go hand in hand with overexcitable nerves within brain areas that process sound. The uncontrolled nerve activity causes the noises that plague people with tinnitus. I can't even pronounce it. Tinnitus, and appears to be down to gene changes. It changes the hope of treatment by silencing nerve activity. Fargo, North Dakota forecasters issuing flash flood warnings already. More than 1,000 people have been evacuated from an area near Bismarck as the Missouri River floods to stage levels they haven't seen in years. A 61-year-old Florida woman lived with her dead mother for 6 years so she could collect her Social Security checks. Penelope Jordan collected more than $60,000 since 2003. Police say that her mother, Timmy Jordan, was found on a bed in a spare bedroom surrounded by clutter. A U.S. man who thought he was dying and confessed to killing a man in 1977 has been charged with murder after he got better. James Brewer could now face the death penalty over the unsolved killing in Tennessee 32 years ago. Convinced he was dying after a stroke, Mr. Brewer reportedly admitted shooting dead the 20-year-old neighbor, Jimmy Carroll. Scientists from Queen's University in Belfast have become the first to study an asteroid before it impacts with Earth. The asteroid in question, 2008 TC3, weighed 80 tons and had a diameter of about 12 feet. It landed in the Nubian Desert in Sudan last October, where it scattered and exploded some 19 miles up. Astronomers from Queen's Astrophysics Research Center observed the asteroid as it hurtled toward Earth and captured the only spectrum of it before it exploded in our atmosphere. Pools of salty water might be able to exist just below the surface of Mars, according to planetary scientists. Researchers previously thought water existed largely as ice or as vapor on Mars because of the low temperatures and atmospheric pressure, but NASA's Phoenix lander has shown the presence in Martian soil of salts, which can keep water liquid at temperatures of minus 70 degrees Celsius. Pockets of brine might form when soil interacts with ice. Science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, does this mean that with salt water comes life?
Basically, because life is mostly composed of salt water. I mean, you and I, when you prick your skin and the blood comes out, if you analyze it, it's mostly salt water in there. So this is an extraordinary step forward, as we've been saying. I hate to use the pun again, but it's drip, drip, drip.
Here you go. You have been found right many times.
Inexorably toward the ultimate announcement, which I think is going to come. I've said this on the show before. In Barack Obama's administration, toward the end of his tenure, the first four years, in December of 2012, when the huge Mars Science Laboratory lands on Mars, it carries instrumentation that will actually be able to detect life if they land in the right place and they're open about what they find. And I'm predicting, years ahead of time that that's when the magic thing is going to happen. And all this drip, drip, drip is leading inexorably to that extraordinary revelation.
It would be nice if they invited you to the event when that time comes,
Richard. Wouldn't that be special, as a church lady used to say?
Sure. Well, speaking of events, you've got one coming up, don't you?
Well, speaking of 2012, I've got one in D.C. coming up this Saturday. Robin and I are leaving at the crack of dawn on Friday. It's the 2012 conference. There is a link on our website. There's also a phone number.
I have it right here.
You have it in front of you, okay.
It's 301-608-1924.
That's right. Now, there's a special announcement to make in regard to this conference.
All right. What is it?
As you know, because I've told you and I haven't told anybody else, I've been in negotiation with NBC News for the last several months. They have made me now a consulting producer on a two-hour primetime special on 2012, which will air November 13th, toward the end of this year, when Roland Emmerich comes out with his major film. And the NBC crew is coming to the D.C. conference to film my four-hour presentation in its entirety. Parts of it will be used in the special. I have some amazing new things to demonstrate. We're basically going to be discussing what does the government know about 2012 and when do they know it, and we have documented evidence from the Pentagon that they have been suspecting something is coming as early as 1947. Does that date ring a bell, George?
It sounds like Roswell all over again.
It certainly does. Now, as part of my duties, I am supposed to prescribe or, relate or intimate or recommend guests. You were my first guest because you probably have sat at the center of the spider's web and talked to more of the serious researchers on the 2012 problem than anybody else on the planet. So I'm hoping that you will not have conflicts and that you can join us. We'll have also people like David Wilcock and David Flynn and my old friend Jay Widener, who is going to be at this conference. If you want to get your picture on television, seriously, if you want to be interviewed to basically describe to NBC and Sci-Fi why you think this is important, why you have come to this conference, why you've shelled out some shekels to show up and listen to what we're all going to present over 2 days, here is your opportunity, and I would recommend strongly that you take it.
Very good. Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. And, Richard, I'd be very proud to be part of your NBC special. So when that time comes, let me know. A United Kingdom couple who went to see a play billed as capable of making you laugh until they throw you out was, the couple tossed out for laughing. Sharon Whitelaw, 41 years old, took her boyfriend, Tony Priestley, to see a production of Bouncers. But at the intermission, they were told not to go back into the auditorium, as other theater goers had complained that they were laughing at moments that simply weren't funny, kicking the seats in front and being loud. So they just simply asked them not to come back. There's another major event heading up for Washington, D.C. in April. In a moment, Stephen Bassett and Grant Cameron join us on Coast to Coast AM. Two guests for you now over the next couple hours as we talk about disclosure. Stephen Bassett, you know him, executive director of the Paradigm Research Group and a leading advocate for ending the government-imposed truth embargo regarding extraterrestrial presence in the human race. He is a political activist, lobbyist, and commentator. Here he is, Stephen Bassett on Coast to Coast. Stephen, welcome.
Always good to be with you, George. How are you?
It's going to be a pleasure. Grant Cameron is a Canadian researcher who has researched a major UFO flap in 1975 and 76, as well as the early Canadian government investigation into flying saucers, including the MJ-12 document and its connection to the former president of Penn State University. Grant works now has pushed him into research stories about UFOs surrounding the president of the United States and the White House. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Grant Cameron. Hello, Grant. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, George. Pleasure
My
to be
pleasure.
On.
Stephen, tell me a little bit about the relationship with Grant Cameron. Some exciting news for both of you.
Well, certainly I've known Grant for some time, going back well before 2000, and been an admirer of him from the beginning. He's one of the most important researchers in the field, having staked out an area of great importance. And as it happens, back in 2003, we came together and made a decision to attempt to publish his work on the U.S. presidents and UFOs, which I think many, if not all of your listeners, are familiar with. And at that time, we had a major publisher, a major agent in New York, working for a pretty top firm, and a book proposal was sent around to virtually every publisher in New York. And it was just turned down, right, 2003. It was disappointment, but the timing was probably not right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is significant because I had wanted from the beginning and felt that this book, it was important that this book be published through a major New York firm and that it be accorded all the appropriate mainstream, how would you say, rites of passage that it deserved, not only the subject matter, but the amount of work that Grant had done. And also because in order to get through to the power structures, that power corridor that exists between New York and Washington, D.C., you need to go that route, right? You need to be published by a major firm. You need to get reviewed. You need to be if have a shot at the bestseller list and so forth. And so I wanted to do that, even though the book could have been self-published at any time or done or taken out through a second or third level, third tier firm. And Grant, my great relief, was willing to go along with this approach and has patiently continued his research for these next 6 years while the opportunity to get this book done right until it came about. And that has, in fact, happened. And we are now signed.
Beautiful.
With a major New York publishing firm, Overlook Press, which is run and founded by legendary publisher Peter Mayer, who was head of Penguin International Division, as well as Avon Books, before he launched Overlook Press. The book will be distributed through Penguin. It's slated to come out in the fall, and we have the full backing of the firm. They're very excited about it, and we're announcing tonight that this work of Grant's will go out by Overlook this year, I think it's going to have significant impact on the events that we're seeing unfolding all around us.
It's dramatic, Stephen. And Grant, let me ask you, how did you, a Canadian researcher and a darn good one, end up specializing in U.S. presidents' involvement with UFOs?
Well, it goes back already to 1975 when I had a number of sightings covering this huge UFO flap that occurred in the province where I live, Manitoba. And so when I first saw the objects that I saw, and a couple of occasions I was only a few feet away from these, one was a small object, one was a large object. And so there was no doubt in my mind that what we were looking at was not something that I considered to be extraterrestrial right from the word go, because it had been written up in the press, and I really wasn't interested. But when I saw it, it sort of changed my life. And so I've always, you have people who believe, people who disbelieve, and then people who know. The people who have been up close and seen it know. So I've always known what was going on. And to me, it was always to sort of get some justification. And so I started on this search of trying to find out what the answer was, who had the answer, tell other people about what had happened, why it was so important and stuff. And I just sort of ran into roadblocks. Like now we have the book, which I have to give great credit to Steve, because Steve is sort of a pusher and he never gave up. And
he never gives up.
And I
I've known him for years.
New York publisher. And I just sat back. And my first experience in publishing was trying to publish the manuscript of the this massive flap that I investigated for a year and a half back in the 70s. I remember the local publisher in a city that I'm in, 700,000 people, it's a fairly big city, the big local publisher, I remember the rejection letter came back to me and said, you may believe in this kind of stuff, count me among the unbelievers. So I was always sort of put off by going first to the publisher, getting turned down, then going and investigating the Canadian government and finding out that in the early years they seemed to have a belief and seemed to try to do something and then just sort of gave up on it. And when that didn't work, then I came across this former president of Penn State University who was a friend of Eisenhower and a number of the presidents and very powerful guy who knew what was going on but sort of talked in rhymes and riddles to us. And we went after this guy for about 8 years, published that book, which only had 1,000 copies. It was an internal publication by MUFON. And it was sort of when I got to there, some of his files were supposed to be at the Truman Library. And I went to the Truman Library, and I can still remember to this day, and this is going back almost 10 years, I went there to look for Dr. Eric Walker's files from Penn State on because we knew he had a UFO file, and we figured it might be there. And I went there, and I remember saying, well, by the way, what kind of UFO files do you have on the president? And they basically said, well, we have a couple of pages, and they basically named off what they had. And I thought, well, this is very strange. I mean, to me, it was the most – it will be 500 years from now the most important subject that's ever come along, the most historic event. And I always knew that from the word go. So I was thinking, well, this is the most powerful guy in the world, and this is the most important subject. Why would the president not be involved in this? And Truman Library is only about 80 miles down the road from Eisenhower Library.
That's right.
So then I went to the Eisenhower Library, and I've been there numerous times. I'm going there in a couple weeks again. But I went to the Eisenhower Library, and I remember them had 5 documents in 28 million pages. And that was at that point that I sort of said, something's wrong here. This guy, if he doesn't know what's going on, should know what's going on. He's the most powerful guy in the world, and this is the most important subject. And so I started on this trek of going to one presidential library after another, looking for the UFO document.
Have you concluded, Grant, that U.S. presidents knew about UFOs or were never told?
Actually, the more I go along, the more confused I get. I, for any president, I can give you 3 examples that show that the president knew and 3 that show that he doesn't know. I know, like, some of them, for example, I think when Steve writes up the book, like Steve is doing the vast majority of the writing, a lot of the book is going to deal with the Clintons because the Clintons were very interested in the phenomena and left an awful lot of documents and left the trails, and now we're going after the documents at the Clinton Library. And Clinton for sure didn't know. I mean, he even said in 2005 in answer to a question when he was asked about, it had nothing to do with UFOs, and in Hong Kong he said, I'm probably not the first president they've lied to, or that they've tried, or that bureaucrats have tried to wait out. I tried to find out about Roswell, and I'm almost embarrassed to say that, but I was not able to find out anything. And it's I think it's a very well-known fact, and I think if Bill Clinton was actually interviewed, he would state quite clearly, yes, he was very interested in the phenomena, fascinated, he told one person, and tried to get the answer, couldn't get the answer. And I think some of my dealings with Edgar Mitchell sort of led me to that. When Edgar Mitchell said that his internal sources said that really no president after Kennedy had been given the insight, track. And I know it's hard to believe that the president may not know what's going on, but in some cases, like with Democrats, it did appear to be true. Like, especially Bill Clinton, it appeared that President Clinton tried to get there and was not able to get the answer. But it's hard to say. There's always indications, for example, just to give you another short example, Charles Huffer, who was...
Well, hold that, Grant, right there. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be back with you and Stephen Bassett. You're both with us for a couple hours tonight with phone calls next hour as well. Stephen Bassett, Grant Cameron, as they try to find out about disclosure. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ah, that's the voice of Paul Anka, and I bring him up because when I was in Vancouver several weeks ago at Talk 1410 at that major event, Paul Anka was just about ready to be there for a full concert, and they were going crazy because Paul is Canadian. And did you know that he wrote a number of songs for even Frank Sinatra, great artist, Paul Anka? Back in a moment with Steve Bassett, Grant Cameron on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Canadian researcher Grant Cameron, Steve Bassett. Stephen, what drives you? I've known you now for close to 12 years. You don't stop. You've been at this every day of your life. How come?
Well, first of all, it's not simply me. I'm not on some lone quest. There has been building since 1991 what we call the disclosure movement, which is an advocacy activist movement to resolve the UFO question politically, which is to say change the government's policy. There are a lot of people out there, a lot of organizations, activists, researchers like Grant, and others who were involved in this in various ways. So I'm part of a much larger process, and obviously it's a lot easier to pursue these things if you are part of a larger process. And believe me, there are people that I deal with that have been at this for 25 years, 30 years.
Oh, Stan Friedman, for example.
Well, Friedman's a researcher, and some of the activists go back, way back. The point is that I came in at a relatively late 1996, and the issue was starting to come together. And I entered just at a time when your illustrious predecessor, Art Bell, made a decision that he wasn't particularly comfortable with, but I think he knew it was the right thing to do, which is to start taking on the political side of this on his show. Even though it wasn't the most charismatic and, you know, entertaining stuff, perhaps, because, you know, he did some great phenomenology and all that, but the politics may have seemed a little dry. But for the people, it represented a real possibility to get to the bottom of this. And so the Art Bell Show became a center for getting the information out to develop political movement to a larger audience. And I got involved in that very early. I figured out pretty soon that this was the most important issue in history, that it was near the end, that it was near resolution of what would be the most profound event in human history, disclosure with a capital D, the acknowledgement event, that it had enormous implications for the nation, the world, that the country in general, which I was fully aware of long before I ever got into the UFO ET issue, was in serious trouble on many levels, which I thought was, you know, not good, because I sort of liked my country. I was born into a Navy family, patriotic, all that. Mm-hmm. We seem to have quite a nation here, not perfect, but getting better all the time. And then it just sort of took a wrong turn, went off into the Thule. So all these implications were there. And so the deeper I got into it, the more important it seemed to me. And so... And then once you get down that road pretty far, you just don't go back. You just can't imagine walking away from something of this magnitude with potential to effectuate change and possibly being involved in that process of change later on to, say, do something of a more mundane nature. So I'm just in it. I entered it late in life. So frankly, if I wanted to turn back, George, I'm afraid it's not an option.
Grant Cameron, how about you? What pushes you?
To me, it's the mystery. It's having seen something up close a number of times, and wanting to sort of resolve it, try to justify it to other people. You know, because I spent my whole life, and most people, you know, they'll listen to the story, but they really couldn't care less.
And to me, it's the game. It's going to the. That's how I spend my holidays. I go to archives, and it's trying to figure it out. And it's like the thrill of like, for example, getting Dick Cheney on the phone, where you pop the question to him, and he actually answers the question, and you're just flying high for days. That's what it is to me. It's a game. It's something I intend to win. And you know, if I was on the other side, I might be playing against it, but. It's just a thrill to do, and it's a big challenge, and I think it's a very important subject. So I'm like Steve. Basically it's all I do is just play the game and try to move the ball down the field, and you know, hopefully we're there when it crosses the goal line.
Okay, I'm going to give you the various presidents, Grant, and very quickly just highlight for us what involvement you think they might have had in this field. You ready?
Yeah.
Harry Truman, first of all.
Well, let's go one back before that, because I'm about to do an interview in Ohio with an 83-year-old woman and her sister, who both tell the story that their father, who's a minister in Ohio, was taken by the longest taken below the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The date they're giving me is 1935. And we're shown bodies on a craft below the Capitol. And this very impressive story, these old ladies telling this story, and told the story by their father in 1948. So I think Roosevelt knew some. There was a crash in 42, which I'm pretty sure he knew about. There was the overflight in Los Angeles that we have documents. Mm-hmm. So I think Roosevelt had some knowledge, had to have had some knowledge if his Secretary of State was running around showing people bodies.
Interesting.
Oh, God, right. That means another chapter.
Here we go. That's right. You better at it. Yeah. Harry Truman.
Harry Truman is the guy who probably had the most control. He's the guy that brought in all the national security state and the CIA and sort of built the intelligence network and tried to get control of the thing. Was involved with the Roswell thing and sort of was able to sort of wrap it up and get it sort of under control and keep the secret, and yet had some control. I think he was one of the presidents that actually did have some control over who was running it and sat on top of the thing.
Dwight Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, very secretive type guy. A lot of stories. There's a story of 54 where he goes to Palm Springs, confirmed the story that he did go. He did disappear. Now there's a story that one of the guys is going to speak at Steve's conference, 1955 Holloman Air Force Base. At first, I doubted because the Truman or the Eisenhower archivist who I deal with told me he'd never been there. But there's a lot of evidence coming out, so I'm going to back to the library in a couple weeks to check that out. And of course, you've got the story about the film. And yep. If it comes to disclosure, if I was talking to Steve about this the other night, if any of what this guy is saying is true. I mean, this thing could unravel very, very fast.
Huge. John F. Kennedy.
Kennedy, I think Kennedy had, I sort of believe he had less impact than a lot of presidents, because he actually didn't even serve one term. But Tim Good is telling a very interesting story that he's told a number of times about Kennedy's Air Force One pilot telling the story that he did go to see the bodies. And Tim Good's a pretty reliable guy, and I think I believe the story. So he did have some major involvement.
Lyndon Johnson, probably not much, I would assume.
Lyndon Johnson, I did a story. I spent a lot of time at the Johnson Library. The Kecksburg crash, when the Kecksburg crashed in December of 1965, the morning after, that's what I do. I go to the library and I check the where the president was, where his top generals were, and all this sort of stuff. The morning after the Kecksburg crash, all the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was at his ranch in Texas. All the Joint Chiefs of Staff flew in. The head of NASA flew in. All the right people flew in. Now, they had the war in Vietnam going on, and the meetings are written up as Vietnam War meetings. But all the people appeared, and there is a one very interesting story that Blue Book records on the Kecksburg crash, which there are, describe a call coming from. They used the code name, and I can't remember what the code name was. But when we tracked the whole code name down, it was the presidential bunker at Mount Weather outside of Washington D.C., where they take the president if there's a nuclear attack. And there was a message came out of there, and we tracked the guy. We know who the guy was that sent the message, and basically talking about material that was being recovered in Michigan. So as the Kecksburg crash is taking place and all this military chatter is going on, the presidential bunker is involved. And Johnson was the type of guy, very secretive and type of guy who was a very powerful guy, wanted to be on top of it. I would not be surprised if he knew an awful lot more than we know right now.
Richard Nixon.
Nixon, I've talked to a number of people, including his second wife, who maintains up and down that Jackie Gleason came home one night and said that he had been with the president and that the president had taken him to an Air Force base in Florida and shown him bodies. And when I checked the story, we have two other people telling the same story that Gleason had told them the story. And when we go and check the presidential record, we find out that the Air Force base where they're claiming the bodies were, where Gleason was taken, was the place that when Nixon went to the Southern White House in Florida, he stopped at this base every single time. He would land at the base and they would take a helicopter.
That is fascinating. Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter is a guy who's now sort of running for cover, denying but a lot of material. No doubt that Jimmy Carter shook every tree he could. He was the guy who had a UFO sighting in 1969 and was determined he was going to get to the bottom of the thing and sent out a bunch of different people, press secretaries, his science advisor, a whole group of people to find out what was going on. And sort of hit a bunch of brick walls. Really wasn't trusted by the military. He had cut the CIA budget and done a bunch of things that made him very unpopular. Was sort of like Bill Clinton, sort of cut out, but did actually achieve quite a bit. The vast majority of the UFO documents that we have from the FBI, from the CIA, from Navy, from a number of the different departments, all came under the Jimmy Carter administration through the Freedom of Information Act, and I think a lot of that had to do with Jimmy Carter opening the door to get this stuff out.
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan was the guy who, as Colin Powell, who was his security advisor, was talking about aliens all the time in meetings, and Colin Powell, one of his jobs, he's openly stated this to a presidential historian, was to keep the Little Green Men speeches out of the Little Green Men references out of speeches, and to whenever he would start talking about it at meetings to try to get him off the topic. He was fascinated with a subject that is quite well known and had two UFO sightings and is famously known to have told Steven Spielberg when he was being shown the movie E.T. the Extraterrestrial in 1982, leaned over to Steven Spielberg and said, I bet you there aren't six people in this whole room who know how true this whole story is. And to add to that, which maybe even Steve doesn't know, I was at the X conference last year. I had a producer, a film producer, come up to me and said she had a top film producer in Hollywood who was telling the same story. And so we went through the whole thing. She took the story back and showed the story off my website, and the guy said, yes, Steven Spielberg told him the same story as well.
Amazing. Gerald Ford, right after Nixon, he wasn't there long. Anything there?
Ford was involved because there was a big flap of UFOs while he was a congressman in Michigan, and J. Allen Hynek, the famous researcher, was in his congressional district, and so he made a number of different efforts when he was a congressman to try to get a congressional hearing going, was very, very outspoken, saying that it wasn't good enough just to say we don't know. And when he got into the White House, just suddenly said nothing and has written a letter that George Filer, who has Filer's files, got from him that said, I tried as congressman, as vice president, and as president to get information on UFOs, and I was always told by officials there was nothing to it.
We've talked about Clinton. How about the two George Bushes?
George Bushes, as I was telling you, I started the story before. Charles Huffer, who was an Arkansas researcher, actually made presidential UFO searching very famous because he was a guy who lived in Arkansas and had a lot of contact with both the Bushes, because when Bushes were in Washington, when they would fly back just before elections, they would fly through Arkansas and land at Fayetteville, Arkansas. And Huffer was always waiting for them. Now, Huffer has just died in the last couple of months, but he managed to get Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. on tape And the more famous one is with Bush Sr., where he said, are you going to tell us what's going on with the UFO thing? And George Bush Sr. said, yeah, if I can find out what it is. And Huffer yelled back, come on, you were CIA man, you know what's going on. And George Bush responded, yeah, I know some, yes, I know a lot. And this is on tape. And then when he confronted Bush Jr. coming back, heading back to, for one election, he stopped there and he asked him, and that's when he said, yes, I'll give you the UFO answer. And he said, this man beside me, and he referred to Dick Cheney, he was Secretary of Defense. He knows what's going on. It'll be the first thing he does when he gets in the White House. And, of course, when nothing happened in the 2004 election, Huffer confronted him coming through Arkansas again, going back the night before the election. And he said, do you remember my promise about the UFOs? And Bush said, yes, yes, I'll do it. And, of course, didn't do anything.
Stephen Bassett, what will history say about Barack Obama?
I believe that Barack Obama is going to be the disclosure president. Now, this, of course, is an assessment of mine based upon a whole bunch of stuff that we could spend 3 hours going into. But he is the right guy at the right time. The music has stopped, and he got the chair. That's my view. It's not sure yet whether we'll be able to get a chapter on Barack in the book. I think it's possible. The manuscript delivery date is the middle of May. The book is slated to come out in the fall. But I should mention that the publisher has been extremely cooperative regarding this book, which, by the way, I think your listeners might be to know, there have been a number of working titles been kicking around. Titling a book is a dynamic process between the authors and the agent and the editor and the publisher and the sales team and all that. Currently, the working title is U.S. Presidents and UFOs, The Untold Story. But there have been others. U.S. Presidents and UFOs, Exopolitics in the White House, and U.S. Presidents and Exopolitics, UFOs over the White House. But currently the working title is U.S. Presidents and UFOs, The Untold Story. And it is. It's not a disclosure treatise. It's not an advocacy work. It is the best accounting, and it's the only book ever to approach the subject from the standpoint of U.S. presidents, focusing on that. And, of course, it is the culmination of 11 years of work by Grant. So it's unique, it's special in a lot of ways. And because of the timing, this book clearly has the potential to impact the disclosure process. And I will go into that more a little bit later. But the publisher has been incredibly cooperative about this book. In other words, they get it. Peter Mayer is a legend. He's a maverick. He is in 2007, he received an award for being the leading independent publisher in the country. I believe it was called the New York Center for Independent Publishers Publishing's Poor Richard Award for outstanding contributions as an independent publisher. He is a legend in the field. They first of all agreed to put the book out this year, which was significant in and of itself because publishers rarely work that quickly. And more importantly, they indicated that if disclosure were to take place, meaning formal acknowledgement of ET presence by the U.S. government or another government, that the book would be put on a fast track and put out, who knows, 30, 40 days. And thirdly, they approved a full pre-publication promotional effort on the part of myself and Grant. This isn't always possible with a book. And some books, you just can't do it. But in this case, it was important. And what that means is that starting right now, a PRG in particular, because Grant's going to be doing heavy research, so I'm going to carry that load. PRG is going to heavily promote this book from this point forward right up to the day that it is released. And there are two reasons for that. One, for this book to have the impact that it should have, it needs to have, and you need to get that message through to the powers that be, it needs to get out there, it needs to be received, it needs to be reviewed, and if we can get some help from perhaps your listeners, we need to get this book on the bestseller list. In fact, I know how the numbers that are involved there, and getting on the bestseller list is not as hard as you think nationwide, and even getting to the top of the list is not impossible. And so we're going to do everything we can to not only pre-sell this book, but to get people aware of its importance and what have you, so that this book gets up there and makes a mark. Not because
because we want to make lots of money, not because we have big egos, I can assure you. It is because that is how you get their attention. And so we're going to be publishing this book. But there is a second very important reason, and that's this. The two key chapters in this book are the Clinton and the Carter chapters.
Mm-hmm.
There's material in those chapters pertaining to a lot of fairly important people. And naturally, we want to make sure that the material in this book is as accurate as possible.
Sure.
And so Grant and I are going to make every effort to interview these individuals to make sure that we get their story, too, and that what we're going to be writing is correct. And these individuals are fairly significant people. In the Carter administration, we naturally are going to try to interview Jimmy Carter, Marcia Smith, President H.W. Bush, and some of the SRI personnel. And after the break, I'll tell you some of the people we're going to interview regarding the Clinton administration.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.